Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about statistics, and maybe statistics with a sort of focus on psychology, experimentation involving humans, maybe even animals, for all I know. And our guest is Lawrence J. Hubert. He is a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Illinois, now lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And we're going to have a nice, interesting conversation. So, Larry, if I may, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Before we get into the role of statistics in modern research and the issues associated with statistical analysis, and there are quite a few, let's talk a little bit about yourself. How did you become a statistician or somebody doing psychology? Let's go back as far as you can for an interesting story of how your career developed at a young age.
Well, I think I became what I am now, or was before I retired, by accident, actually. When I was in junior high, the United States had a major shakeup in terms of an event that happened. Sputnik went up.
A number of times on this radio show in 27, 30 years, I've heard that. That was a remarkable episode in this country.
It was an incredible wake-up call for the U.S. And so I had planned at that point. I was in the eighth grade when that went up. I had planned to be a cabinet maker and planned to go on to a career with my hands and the trades. At that particular point, I don't know if you remember the time, but immediately they tested every single student, I think, in the United States for aptitude, science and math.
I didn't know that. I was in England at the time as a student.
And when I went into the counselor at that point, because I was going into the ninth grade, and informed him that my interests were to get into one of the curricula that were devoted to the trades, he said, it's not the way it's going to be for you. And so I found myself very early on, ninth grade, the summer, whisked away to a college to do a kind of a crash number of week class in physics, chemistry, math, and bio.
Where was this?
St. Olaf College in Minnesota.
Also Minnesota.
Yeah. Ah. And thereafter, I started off into a curriculum that was science-oriented, directing me to do that, and I did.
You know, that's just interesting from so many levels, because you think of the Soviet system or the East European system of, say, training athletes, and they would go out and find these kids with aptitude at a very young age, and then there was this crash career. Getting them to a higher and higher and higher level. And it's very successful, but that's not American, right? Where you don't take young kids anymore, I think, and sort of stream them. You just let them all go along and make their own decisions. And maybe there's a discussion there about the best way to educate a nation.
Well, one of the things that that happened along with that push is the funding to go to college and to go to graduate school was done. Yeah. I went to probably some of the better schools in the United States and never actually paid a penny in tuition, took no loans of any kind. And so my undergraduate degree was at Carleton College in Minnesota. I majored in mathematics and psychology. I went again on a competition to Harvard and received a master's degree in teaching mathematics. And then I went to Stanford to on a grant from the U.S. Office of Education.
Not a bad pedigree.
Yeah.
Right? And all because you were picked out.
Right.
And so you've got to thank the Soviet Union for having some really good scientists and aerospace engineers.
Right. There is that.
Right, for your career.
Right. Yeah.
So we heard the psychology, we heard math, we heard education. And so how did that translate now into your career?
Well, when I went to Stanford in the 60s, I was planning on being in math education. I was interested in how math was taught at that particular point, and I planned to do that for my career. when I got to Stanford, the person that was in charge of the math ed program, he and I didn't seem to get along very well. And so I cast around for another major professor to work with that was in the same program, and I chose Pat Soupy's.
You were lucky you found that out before you had a commitment.
Oh, yes.
Because one of the big issues with that I train a lot of students that go on for graduate programs, I said, you've got to make sure that there's a compatibility.
Right.
They're only going to be very nice to you for that first week or two to sort of inveigle you in.
You're right.
But what comes for the next 3, 4, 5 years?
Right. Well, I made a good choice. Pat Soupy's was another individual who covered many, many areas. He had appointments in philosophy and education and statistics. And so I worked on mathematical modeling in psychology with him. But when I graduated, unfortunately, there were no jobs available for math modelers, per se. But I had taken a lot of statistics along the way, so my first position was in a Department of Ed Psychology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I became a statistician within that context.
Okay, so seamless flow,
yeah,
as you look back on it. But at the time, there were many decisions you had to make that it wasn't clear if they were right until they developed.
Yeah, it's what we refer to as the accidental career choice path.
But now, you know, stimulated by good Russian engineering and science. So now let's talk a little bit about then, what does somebody with a really good math and statistics background, how do you fit into a psychology department? I mean, naively, I would think, well, then this is the person that's going to interact with Professor X, Y, and Z all over the department because they're doing experimental work, they're collecting data, and they're not particularly sharp at the statistical analysis part. And that's where I would have thought maybe it was a career would develop, but I'm probably wrong.
Well, I think any behavioral science department or any educational psychology department that has a doctoral program has a very strong, or usually has a very strong quantitative division. In educational psychology, there is a need for test and measurement, explicitly test development. In psychology, there's a need explicitly for designing experiments. And every place that I know of that is ed psych or psychology requires the graduate students to take a substantial amount of statistics, experimental design, and those are the classes that I've taught.
I can see the point about the teaching requirement, but individual creative research, you're mainly having to collaborate, or did you strike out in
There's two kinds.
Yes.
Sometimes departments want somebody just to teach. It's typically referred to as the hiring a mule to teach all of the classes with no interest at all in promoting somebody's research career within that context. Good departments of psychology and good departments of educational psychology are interested in their faculty, even though they have to teach the various required classes, developing their own research career quantitatively and not through just collaboration with other faculty members. In fact, we refer to that aspect of our jobs as playing well with others. And if we play well with others, sometimes we get on their papers, but it's not our own interest.
I understand.
Yeah. And we spend a lot of time, or at least I have spent a lot of time over the years, working with graduate students on their own research and being on their committees. I must have served on some 500 dissertation committees over the years.
That's a lot.
And with responsibility for, you know, the methodological accuracy of what is being done.
Right. So do you have your own statistical approach that is saying, you know, this is research in the pure way of analysis?
Yes, to some extent. When I started off, I started to work in an area called cluster analysis, data representation methods generally, multidimensional scaling, and I have, you know, a number of books that I wrote on that are not textbooks that are usually at an upper level.
So when you started, let's think back to when you just became the assistant professor, and then you've got to show your talents and your activity and get tenure. Did you get, at that stage, were you being the mule, or were you being playing well with others, or did you have this third string at the same time?
Well, my first job was at, as I mentioned, at Madison, and it was in Ed Psych. And there was a, within Ed Psych, there was a strong quantitative component. I had a number of colleagues there. And the expectation was for me to, besides doing the teaching, which was kind of part of the job, is to develop an independent research program in quantitative matters. And I did that. I ended up getting interested in cluster analysis and scaling methods in general, data representation methods. And I kind of hit on a novel approach to that topic, which was very productive for me. And I did get tenure. And
so let's just put it into simple talk so Keith can understand.
Okay.
Cluster analysis and an interesting approach to it. What does that mean the lay person?
Cluster analysis itself is grouping things. How do you form groups? So based upon available data that may be on a set of other variables, or you may ask individuals to directly relate how similar various objects are, your job then is to take that data and form, hopefully, the various kinds of groups that hopefully have independent meaning, or that you can assign independent meaning. It gets a lot more complicated, but now the techniques that I worked on back in the 70s, these are the bread and butter of all the big data people. So various kinds of cluster analysis, classification techniques form the core, really, of all the push now on machine learning and big data, really.
Can you give us a specific example of you know, where that data comes from, what are the questions being asked, how is the data generated, and what subclusters within a big cluster you could identify?
Yeah, let's do within a medical context. There is a lot of work done on various kinds of cancers where you hopefully have these things called microarrays that show various kinds of genes expressing in various kinds of cancers. And so what you would like to do is to figure out what cancers are associated with what clusters of genes. And so hopefully you can use some sort of classification methods to identify meaningful and clinically relevant subgroups in your data. Right now, people are very worried about not saying cancer is one monolithic thing, that certain kinds of cancers can be identified based upon the genetic structure that's involved. And these cluster analysis techniques in various forms are useful for that particular purpose.
And there's been some major advances in treatment of cancer because of that type.
Yeah. In fact, one of my colleagues that I was with as an undergraduate was Claire King. She was the one that eventually discovered the BRCA gene for breast cancer. And so that is the kind of, you know, enterprise that I'm interested in, but from a numerical point of view.
Great. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Emeritus Lawrence Hubert from the University of Illinois, and we're talking about the role of statistics, statistical analysis in modern research across the field. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Lawrence Larry Hubert from the University of Illinois, Emeritus Professor of Psychology, and statistician extraordinaire. Okay, now, statistics doesn't have a good name. I mean, it all started, I think, with Benjamin Disraeli. There's lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. Let's delve into that little aphorism for a little. Why is there, or was there, and is there still that disparaging concept about statistics?
Well, I'm not sure where to exactly start on that. I view what I do not necessarily as computational. There's a lot of techniques that we can do where we do various kinds of functions on numerical values and say, these are statistics, you know, believe them, right? I'm much more interested in looking at data to answer certain questions. I'm really interested in how we can reason probabilistically rather than giving a number and saying, this is what you should believe. And I think the notion of statistics being bad comes from the idea that people don't kind of understand that statistics, just as numbers, don't really mean anything. There's a lot of books that have been published about misinterpreting statistics. There's a man, a sociologist, who has written a number of wonderful books. His name is Joel Best, on numbers and how they can be very badly construed in a number of contexts. So I think he's trying to debunk that notion of lies, damn lies, and statistics.
So you talk about probabilistic approaches, and probability is something that also is highly confusing to people who are not steeped in science, right? The probability that something exists is never zero.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Almost. You know, that there are molecules in the ether that are going at phenomenal high speeds with high energy. Probability is they're out there. And yet, that's difficult for people to understand.
Exactly.
So that's one of the confusing things, you know, about probability, that it's also a difficult thing to get your head around.
Right.
Let's just jump to something else that's sort of coming out these days, and that is reproducibility. Right? There have been several articles, and I'm sure even books, about the fact that a lot of experimental data, especially in the health area, dealing with human behavior, maybe treatment for different diseases, a lot of this work is not readily reproduced. And that may be because there's no standard ingredients that are used. It may be because the statistical analysis has not been quite up to par, let's say. Do you have some thoughts about that as an area?
Well, yes. There's one individual who I believe now is at Stanford. His name is John Ioannidis. And he kind of made a splash some number of years ago with an article, I think in PLOS Science, that was entitled something of why most research results are false. And this was done in the medical area primarily. And the argument goes is that if we rely upon things like statistical significance only, which we all know is very heavily dependent upon sample size, we can find, for example, trivial results to be, quote, statistically significant when they're not very important. And there's a whole range of techniques that we can follow to try to find statistical significance in any study. People refer to this now as p-hacking, trying to search for results that you didn't look for in the first place, but, you know, searching your data and looking through, you say, ah, a result.
Which, of course, actually can be very creative.
Which can be very creative, but yeah. you can't just search through and then say, here it is, and believe that it will be necessarily replicable the next time around. And that's really the crux of the issue, that if you search for something without kind of specifying what you're looking for beforehand, you can be misled. And psychologists right now have this incredible program of trying to reproduce results that supposedly were kind of stable over the the last 50 years, and they're finding that they can't replicate them. And this is a huge problem for, you know, the development of any science.
Give us a typical example of something that fundamentally was understood and now is questioned.
Well, some of this is actually in the popular literature. There's a piece that was done in the New Yorker by Jonah Lehrer some time ago, where he talks about this phenomenon of what's called verbal overshadowing, which was really kind of a stable psychological phenomenon. And it turns out that upon attempted replications, it's disappeared.
Well, I don't know what verbal overshadowing
you know, it's a technique. You know, psychologists are good at
yeah, but what does it mean? Tell us.
Well, there's certain phenomenon in psychology that says if you kind of show somebody something, that you're priming them to think about things in certain ways. You know, if you show a picture of a minority member threatening something in terms of another individual, and then later on you ask questions about people being violent as a group, you've been primed before, and you tend to answer in certain ways that may not actually reflect what your true beliefs might be.
A considered opinion, in other words. Right.
These kinds of psychological phenomena tend to be very ephemeral, subtle, and they're not very well replicable. Even though people read about these in their psychology textbooks, they seem to be not quite as stable phenomenon as we would like.
That's interesting. So I know for a fact in what I do, I'm a chemist, and I know that there are people who have made careers about reinvestigating science and chemistry that was done at the end of the 19th century, where the technologies weren't available for a really powerful analysis of the materials. That's slightly different but maybe it's the same, because now we've got tools like X-ray analysis and, you know, nuclear magnetic resonance. So we can do really good analysis on materials. Are you saying that now we've got better statistical analysis techniques that we can go back and look at some of these experiments that were done in psychology that you're talking about, this overshadowing, and now we've got a better way to analyze all the data, and therefore we're coming up with a reassessment?
No, that's not it.
Okay,
no,
so
that's not it.
What is it then?
Well, it really is that things that we thought were there were not really there.
But why were they thought to be there? What's happened?
When you collect data, usually you don't collect just one number. You collect a lot of information. And if you look around your data set and you do repeated tests of significance and you rely upon statistical significance as a way of saying you have a result, you're just going to get into trouble, because it's very easy to find things that are just artifacts, happenstance. And once you find a result, you want to get it published.
Tenure.
Get tenure. Editors love to get positive results. They're not going to publish things that there's no good result there. And so from a perspective of one's livelihood.
This is grim.
It is grim.
I don't get my enthusiastic response to what I'm listening to. I do know a few years ago there were some papers published by, there was a researcher, I think his name is Rees, R-E-E-S, down at MD Anderson with a colleague at Merck, reinvestigating experimental data for translational drug therapy for oncology and coming to a similar conclusion that you said Ioannidis did. That is, 70% of this was not reproducible. Now, that could be because of materials slightly differing, but something's rotten in the state of Denmark. And I don't know if, is this the pressures that you were talking about just now, that it's simply people rushing into print, not thinking cogently?
Yes, I think it is. And it's not only limited to psychology. It's really rampant in the medical area. You know, if you look at some of the historical fiascos, kind of like, let's say, the pharmaceutical industry, we have many examples where things that were assumed to be pretty good turned out to be really harmful. Vioxx is one good example in terms of a drug. So,
and that was because the number of examples where people were being analyzed was too small.
Well, yes, but if you think about side effects and bad things that happened, and you have a fairly small sample where you're testing the efficacy of a drug, for example, and you find that there is one or two really bad things that happen, in the sense of these one or two in relationship to, let's say, the 1,000 that you have in your trial, it doesn't look too bad.
Yes.
But then when you take that, if those are, quote, real, and say, well, now let's make the base of 1,000,000. Let's put it on the market.
Yeah.
Then you start to have an awful lot of really bad stuff happening. If you look at the ads on TV now, they will say, if you or your loved ones have ever taken such and such, call this lawyer and he's going to get you some money.
The other side of that coin is I watch a lot of soccer, and there's always advertisements aimed at males. Do you have this? Do you have that? You know,
right.
And if you have this, and it's a very technical name, so only the people who've got it know they've got it. Right. And then, here's a drug that you might think about.
Right.
But, of course, you do realize that, and death. There's this disclaimer right at the end.
Right.
Where's the silver lining in that rather a grim sort of analysis?
Well, I think the silver lining is that there should be a recognition that one has to be very, very careful about assuming that one has found a true result without a lot of replication work, a lot of cross-validation, for one. And I think there are also some individuals, organizations that are very careful now about how this stuff is done. We have one good example of an individual who is doing marvelous things for statistics. His name is Nate Silver. Nate Silver has a blog called the 538. He now works for ESPN, but Nate is said to make statistics sexy again for us because he runs the various polls for the elections, and he does it in a very elegant and correct way.
We've come to the end, Larry. This has been a very interesting conversation. I want to thank you for being here on Science Studio. We've been talking to Professor Emeritus Lawrence Hubert from the University of Illinois, eminent statistician. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
And we'd like to thank Norma Martinez for editing this. And we'll be back next week with a different program. So thank you very much. Bye-bye.